Previously on Beta.
Jokes. Oh, I want to make jokes. Gotta make jokes. There's nothing I love better than making jokes.
Jesus, it's like Iwo Jima out there. Any news?
He might lose his foot.
Right when he got it in the door.
I can name that tune in 5 notes.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, TV critics Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall reflect back on Matthew Weiner's 60s advertising epic, Mad Men.
One of the things I thought was great about the show was when they were dealing with major events of the time, it was very rare that they would do an episode that was just about that event.
And we strap in for another rock and roll thought experiment. Today, music blogger Joshua Farber on how cover songs can expand our musical horizons.
Listening to someone else interpret the songs of Bob Dylan became a kind of outlet for me to be able to enjoy his work and bring my own sensibility to it.
But first, Mike Sacks. Mike hosts a podcast called Doing It with Mike Sacks. He's also the author of Poking a Dead Frog. In both the podcast and the book, he features interviews with some of today's top comedy writers. He's spoken with innovators, including Parks and Recreation and The Good Place creator Mike Schur, legend Mel Brooks, and Onion writer Carol Kolb. Mike says that we're living in a golden age of comedy.
Well, I think that compared with 15, 20 years ago, there's a lot more opportunities now for anyone. So a 14, 15-year-old girl in Maryland can compete with the best New Yorker writers by having as many readers potentially. She has that opportunity to do that. A sketch group in the middle of the country can post videos to their site that can be viewed as many times as the most popular professional comedic group. So just because one has the opportunity does not mean that they can then become instantly famous or instantly successful, but the opportunity is there and it never used to be there.
There's this perception that all comedy writers are miserable, and I'm curious, based on your conversations with so many different comedy writers and your own work as a comedy writer, do you think that's true?
Yep, I do. The thing is, though, everyone's miserable. We just happen to hear about it from comedy writers. You know, I think if you were to go into your dentist, he'd be miserable, but his job is not to tell you jokes about how his relationship with his wife is breaking up. I don't know if comedy writers are more miserable than other occupations. We do happen to hear about it more. I do think that there's a strong connection between depression, anxiety, and OCD in comedy, specifically OCD. And I only asked these writers because I too suffer from OCD. I asked David Sedaris. He's written about it, so I knew the answer to this, but he was talking about it. And from there, I would ask each of the writers if they happen to suffer from it. And I would say about 75% suffer from symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder. But what's interesting is a lot of these writers use that compulsion, that feeling of compulsion, to write every day. And because of that, it sort of feeds into their success. So they funnel that energy rather than washing their hands or licking light poles or whatever. They funnel that obsessiveness into having to write every day. And if they don't, they get anxious. So it's not a pleasant way to live necessarily, but they've taken the best of a bad situation and have made the best of it.
I have some OCD tendencies myself, and I can see where it would be handy, especially for stand-up comedy, where because I've tried stand-up comedy a bit over the years, and I could see where it would come in handy when you have to rework bits, where you have to do the same material over and over, and then figure out which parts didn't work, which did, and rework it. I could see where OCD would also possibly be a benefit there.
Oh, definitely. Very specific work. It's like working on jewels. Very concentrated, little changes day after day after day until you get it right. You absolutely do need an obsessiveness. And what's interesting, too, is even someone like Mel Brooks, whom I interviewed, you still sense that he's obsessive. Even with all the accomplishments he has achieved, he's still obsessive about working and getting the laugh, which I found fascinating. So for him, it was never about money. It was never about anything but producing laughs. Mm-hmm. And writing comedy and performing comedy, and he still feels the same way.
When I look at you, I don't get insecurity. When I look at your comedy, there's never been a hint of insecurity coming from your comedy.
No.
Is that fair?
It is. I've never shown it. But there is an enormous amount of anxiety behind it, but I'm a brilliant and skilled performer and actor. It's true.
Yes,
and I cover it with a great deal of bravado.
Yes.
One of the things that I think really defines great comedy is the element of surprise. There's this Albert Brooks quote that you've probably come across in an interview where he says that, to me, the whole point of comedy is just to go bleeping crazy and try things that are as wild as your brain can think of and do them again if they don't work. Do them again. Believe me, the audience comes to you. And I guess Andy Kaufman could be the spokesmodel for this idea. Yet it seems to me anyway that there are certain standard tropes that people find inherently funny. So my question is, how do you find a balance between the element of surprise and freshness and still maintain the comedy?
Yeah, that's the big question. I mean, if you go back thousands of years to Aristophanes' plays, you can see jokes that you would hear at any comedy, not the same jokes. You're not going to hear donkey jokes, I guess, but the same jokes about humans and human behavior and sex and bodily functions and all this sort of thing. And we're all wired to recognize certain human behavior. So it's a matter of working within that framework while also standing out. That's the real trick. Now, what's interesting is Albert Brooks is a genius, and his stand-up was absolutely amazing. But the problem with that sometimes is that you can be ahead of your time with both his movies and his stand-up.
Here I am, 5 years into my career. I have no more material left. It surprised the hell out of me. I'll be honest with you, last Thanksgiving, while you people were celebrating, I was down to my last bit. I ignored all those time to write more signs, and I'll tell any young comedians watching, if you get down to the last 20%, it's as good as nothing. Okay, now look, I think there's more inside of me. There has to be more bits in here. It's just at this time in my life, it's so deep that I'll do injury to myself to go in and get it.
So it's also a matter of not just putting good work out there that works within the framework that's different from anyone else. It's also timing. And to be too ahead of your time sometimes, especially when it comes to comedy, is not necessarily a good thing for your career. It can be a very frustrating career.
Well, and Steve Martin also has talked about, in his memoir, Born Standing Up, about being kind of ahead of his time and just sort of willing to embrace that, to do this weird material and to make it clear to the audiences when he was first starting out that, hey, this is funny. I think this is funny.
But that was a rare case of him doing what he wanted to do, doing it very differently and hitting huge. You know, he would fill stadiums. Very, very, very rare. I don't know of any other case that was like, Richard Pryor eventually, but that took years after he had changed his act. And yeah, but Steve Martin, it comes down to, I think, the fact he's just brilliant and the writing was phenomenal, as was the performance.
Hey, I don't like to gear my material to the audience, but I'd like to make an exception because I was told that there is a convention of plumbers in San Francisco this week, and I understand about 30 of them came down to the show tonight. So before I come out, I worked up a joke especially for the plumbers. And now those of you who aren't plumbers probably won't get this and won't think it's funny, but I think those of you who are plumbers will really enjoy this. And so if you're not a plumber, please just bear with me for a while and just kind of hold off on this, but I would like to do this for the plumbers. So here we go. This lawn supervisor was out on a sprinkler maintenance job. And he started working on a Finlay sprinkler head with a Langstrom 7-inch gangly wrench. Well, just then a little apprentice leaned over and said, you can't work on a Finlay sprinkler head with a Langstrom 7-inch wrench. Well, this infuriated the supervisor, so he went and got volume 14 of the Kinsley manual. And he reads to him and says, the Langstrom 7-inch wrench can be used with the Finlay sprocket. Just then, the little apprentice leaned over and says, it says sprocket, not socket. Well, those plumbers supposed to be here this show, or was that?
You talked to a guy named Tom Sharpling about his radio show, The Best Show on WFMU, which aired on the independent community radio station WFMU from 2000 to 2013. This is a show with a huge cult following. Can you tell me about it? What's it about?
This show is pretty amazing. This is some long-form comedy, meaning 30, 45, one-hour-long bits, which you do not see anywhere else. It reminds me of a modern Bob and Ray in the sense that Tom would play records, he would take calls, and every show or most shows, he would receive a call from a character played by John Worster, who's also an amazing drummer for Bob Mould and Superchunk and the Mountain Goats. Brilliant guy. And he would play these characters that would confuse the radio audience. The radio audience would not know this was a put-on. He would go on for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, take calls, incensed the callers. Tom would play off them. Tom was a great straight man. And they would just create this world. And they created a world called Newbridge, which was an imaginary town in New Jersey. This town almost became like the Simpsons town in that there was hundreds of characters. There was direct relations between certain characters. It was a history of Newbridge. And over the years, like a very, very strange, like Wobegon, it just grew and grew and grew, and to the point that it became sort of a cult favorite among top comedy writers.
You also talked to someone that we wouldn't necessarily think of as a comedy writer, the novelist and short story writer George Saunders, who admittedly his fiction is very funny. Well, why did you want to talk to him?
Well, that was one of the things I was thinking about when writing this book. Who is a comedy writer? Is it someone who sits in a room and writes jokes for TV only? And I eventually decided just to go with anyone who made me laugh. And George makes me laugh. I think he's a genius. He's also an incredibly smart teacher of writing. He teaches at Syracuse. His reputation is as one of these teachers who can make a connection with audiences, who came at writing from a different angle. He was an engineer. He didn't always start off wanting to be or working as a writer. And I think what he does is combine comedy and horror and satire better than any other writer out there now that I know of. You know, he's not a comedy writer in the strict sense. I would label him a serious writer, but I've always found what he does funny, if only on a deeper level, perhaps, than a late night show.
Mike Sacks is a comedy writer and the host of the podcast Doing It with Mike Sacks. He's also the author of Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. Find out more about Mike at WPR.org/beta.
It was my favorite show to write about because there was so much to unpack, so many levels on which everything took place, and there's barely been anything in the year since it ended that has given me quite the same level of joy when it comes time to do any kind of episodic recapping.
That's Rolling Stone's chief TV critic Alan Sepinwall on the AMC series Mad Men. He and fellow TV critic Matt Zoller-Seitz join us next. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
My first job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent.
That's John Hamm from AMC's hit series Mad Men. As we enter a new decade, we thought it might be fun to revisit the show that covered one of the most dynamic decades of American history, the 1960s. 5 years ago, Matthew Weiner wrapped his meticulously detailed advertising epic after 7 seasons on the air. Matt Zoller-Seitz is editor-at-large of RogerEbert.com and a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. He's also the author of Mad Men Carousel, The Complete Critical Companion. We welcomed Matt and his frequent collaborator, Rolling Stone's chief television critic, Alan Sepinwall, to talk about the impact of Mad Men and discuss their favorite moments from the show. Matt says that the beginning and end to his appreciation of the show is how layered its storytelling is.
It operates simultaneously on at least five levels at the same time in pretty much every scene. You know, on level one is plot and character, what happens next and who it happens to. Level two is the character's relationship to their own psychology and how much are they aware of the construction of their character, and if so, what do they do about it? And are they acting on good information or bad information? And then level three is their relationship to their environment, specifically New York City, but also increasingly Los Angeles and the United States as a whole. And level four is their relationship to American history, and it covers a time span of 1960 to 1971, and that was a period of enormous societal change, not just within the white upper middle class, which is the main sort of demographic segment represented on the show, but also within all of these social groups that occasionally intrude on that sphere and cause them to reevaluate themselves. And then the fifth and final level is time. Is time. Is, you know, the show is looking at the cycles of personal history and how they repeat, and also cycles of history and how they repeat, and the flashbacks of Don's childhood in the 1930s, which I came to believe were more his imagining than a representation of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of the same fears and concerns and aspirations happening in the 1930s that were happening in the 1960s. And then by implication, I guess we're probably dealing with our own version of this stuff. And I think we are.
Well, why are Mad Men's characters so true to life?
I think it's because they do what those characters would do. You know, I think more than almost any other television show I can think of, the psychology of those characters has been thought through on such a deep level that even when they do something that seems out of character, it only takes you a few minutes after thinking about it to realize, yeah, that is in fact the sort of thing that they would do. Like the fact that Peggy, you know, Peggy's character, despite being this really careful, meticulous, driven sort of professional woman, is constantly getting involved in self-destructive affairs with men who are bad for her in some way. You know, and she keeps doing it, and you get to late in the show and you're like, why is she doing something like this? Hasn't she learned anything? And it's like, yeah, maybe she has on some level, but she's Peggy, so this is what she does. And you see this happen again and again with all the major characters. They keep trying to escape themselves. They keep trying to escape their essence or discover it. And they have varying degrees of success, and a lot of this has to do with how well they really know themselves. Like, do they really know themselves, or do they just think they do?
Yeah. Yeah, Mad Men's creator Matthew Weiner has said that he's always assumed that people have the same feelings as him, and he's usually right. They just won't admit it. Do you think that that's one of the reasons why the characters are so true to life? Does he just have do a good job of tapping into the human condition?
I think so, but I also think he knows a lot about psychoanalysis and therapy, and that probably helps.
That's right, he does. Good point. Now, there's one moment in Mad Men that really seems to be cited a lot as the moment the show made the leap to greatness. It was the finale of season one, and the episode is called The Wheel. Alan Sepinwall, can you give us a brief synopsis of this episode and give us your take on why it was so powerful?
Well, Don Draper has to give the presentation of a lifetime. They're trying to get the Kodak account. And meanwhile, his relationships have been falling apart. He's been worried that he's going to be outed for, you know, his identity as Dick Whitman. He's thought about running away with Rachel Menken, and just nothing is going right for him. And, you know, he feels like he's on the verge of losing everything, and he's not sure what he cares about. And he goes in. And he gives this presentation where he talks about nostalgia being more important than, you know, forward thinking in science fiction. And he starts showing these slides of his family. And it's like doing this presentation, he's really seeing his own life for the first time. And he's realizing, like, how much he's been missing and how little he appreciates this thing. He's a stranger in his own existence. And by the end of it, he's fallen in love with this family that he thought he wanted to run away from. And he goes home and they're not there.
This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards, forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel.
Yeah, and it's also on a meta level, I think it's beautiful because he's lying. He's getting up there and he's lying. Like he's presenting these sort of hazy golden-tinted images with a catch in his voice, and he actually moves people to tears in his speech. But this is a family that he alienated through his own increasingly rotten behavior throughout the course of that season. And this is something that Don does time and time again, is he reaches into his own life, often into his own pain, and he extracts something that makes for good advertising, and often he wins awards for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's better in advertising than he is as a person. The version of him that finds its way into the campaigns is always an idealized version, and then we see the rotten reality when he goes home.
Well, of course, what is Don Draper but an advertisement anyway?
Yeah.
You know, like we know from watching the show that that's not who he actually is. This is this thing that he constructed.
Yeah. Would this episode make your top 10 list?
I think it would have to.
Yes. That's when you think about Mad Men, the carousel pitch is one of the three mm-hmm. or four scenes that first come to mind, and in some ways the most important one to understanding the main character of the show.
Yeah. Do you both have – can you each identify a specific favorite episode?
I mean, it's the suitcase. It has to be the suitcase, at least for me. It's the one where Don and Peggy are in the office together all night. It's, I believe, the middle episode of the series numerically. So it's like the pivot point. And, you know, they've been through so much together, and yet there's still this huge distance between them. And then over the course of this episode, all the barriers get broken down. They speak honestly about a whole lot of stuff. And it doesn't magically repair their relationship. She quits the agency later, and they go through some other things. But, you know, it's the first time that they really start to treat each other as something resembling equals. And the performances by Ham and by Elizabeth Moss are, you know, two of my favorite things in the entire run of the show right there.
You gave me 20 ideas, and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we going to shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
You got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for.
How about you, Matt?
Well, I'm going to cheat here a little bit, and
that's
I'm going to say that while I love the suitcase, I do think it's one of the great episodes. The two episodes that I keep coming back to that to me kind of sum up everything that made this show great. There are two episodes from season three, and one of them is Guy walks into an advertising agency. Yes, and then the other one is the grown-ups.
Okay.
And here's what I love about this. And I talked about at the top of this interview about all the different layers on which the show operates.
Yeah, five
simultaneously.
Of them.
Okay. So
yeah.
Saying about the five levels here, like we're building, as soon as we know what year it is, we're thinking this is the season where they kill Kennedy. And how are they going to do it? Because we've seen Kennedy's assassination enacted several times. Now, it's set on the July 4th weekend, 1963, so it's several months in advance. But we have the British owners of the advertising agency come to visit. And what happens to this guy is he gets his foot run over by a lawnmower, which is being driven in a pattern that is identical to the movements of the convertible in Dealey Plaza. And you can actually – I'm serious. I have synced up the footage of Dealey Plaza with the lawnmower sequence, and they even break at exactly the same frame.
Wow.
That's how meticulous this is. And right down to, Joan spending the rest of the episode with blood on her dress just like Jackie – And also the way that this is structured like a horror movie. It's like a premonition of the Kennedy assassination that happens months before the actual assassination in the timeline. And then, check this out, we get to the grown-ups. We get to the actual Kennedy assassination episode. And how did they tell us that this is the Kennedy assassination episode? They begin with a scene in an advertising agency. Pete and Harry Crane are sitting at their desk. There's a television. It's a wide shot. There's a television on in the background behind them. And you see the special bulletin logo come up. And we, the audience, know what that means. We know, oh, my God, they killed Kennedy. This is the episode where they deal with that. And what happens is we're looking at that and we're thinking, turn around, turn around. Don't you see what's behind you? Which is the reaction you have when you're watching a horror movie in the theater.
What does it mean?
It's not good.
I know it's not good. There's no future for me here. How did you do it? You made your job up.
I didn't. I looked at other agencies and saw that they had TV departments and wondered why we didn't.
Well, there's no such thing in the accounts field.
I'm gonna die at this desk unnoticed. Do you have any idea what I've done for this company?
What are you doing?
Christ, somebody shot the president.
What?
The top of the president's car was down,
They drew their pistols, but the damage was done. The president was knocked over in the back seat of the car, face down.
You're like, turn around. It's right behind you. The horror is right there behind you. Why don't you see it? And so you've essentially got a premonitory nightmare of the Kennedy assassination, and then several episodes later, the actual nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. Matt, you had a Twitter conversation with a critic named Miles McNutt in which he distinguished between theme episodes and episodes with themes. What's the difference?
Well, a theme episode, I think it's just a matter of subtlety. Like a theme episode is the theme of this episode is we don't really listen to each other. And in scene after scene, you see characters failing to listen to each other. You know, it's like it can be more kind of boringly executed, whereas an episode with a theme, it's sort of embedded in the action and embedded in the characters, and maybe it takes you a minute to figure out that there is a theme, you know? Like I think going back to season one, the episode that Alan mentioned, there's a three-episode arc at the end of season one that is very heavy on the election of 1960 and Kennedy versus Nixon and this idea that, you know, those represented two sort of modes of looking at the world and ways of behaving. And all of these characters in the show, including Don and Pete and Roger and Bert and everybody else, they're kind of exemplifying Kennedy or Nixon at various points in the story. And ultimately, this leads to this crisis that Don has over his true identity being revealed.
Don, you should think about how Bert Cooper will react when he hears this information.
What information?
You're not who you say you are. And there's obviously a reason.
Come on.
I would like you to reconsider my qualifications.
You said everything except or else. When you threaten someone in this manner, you should be aware of the fact that if your information is powerful enough to make them do what you want, what else can it make them do?
You see it in Don's character, how he's politically... He's very liberal and he allies himself with the Bohemians and he wants to escape from the rules, but he's also incredibly reactionary in some ways. And it's like he's sort of Kennedy and Nixon at the same time. And I think that becomes even more clear as the show goes on.
Yeah. So episodes, episodes with themes are the majority of Mad Men episodes, right?
I think the really good ones are. Yeah. I mean, there were some times where they maybe hit things a little too hard, a little too obviously. There were a few episodes in season two and season four, particularly, where I felt like they were going at it a little too obviously, but they never did anything on the level of a lot of bad TV that was set in the '60s. Mm-hmm. And I will give them credit. One of the things I thought was great about the show was when they were dealing with major events of the time, it was very rare that they would do an episode that was just about that event and everybody reacting to something on TV. Like they would have a little bit, but they always found a way to mix it up. Like in The Grown-Ups, some people are reacting to the coverage of the Kennedy assassination. There are other characters who seem completely unaffected by it, and there are other characters who don't even know that it happened until after the fact.
Yeah. So how much of the appeal of Mad Men has to do with nostalgia? Alan, what do you think?
I don't know that it's nostalgia necessarily, although certainly there were people like, wow, like these guys look cool. These outfits look great. You know, look how much January Jones looks like Grace Kelly, all of these things. But I think it's less about the period than it is about the specificity of it. And, you know, there's certainly stories that have been told about Matthew Weiner that make it sound like obsessive, bordering on like maniacal about getting all of these details correct. But you can kind of feel it when you watch it. It feels like, you know, this world that you have, you know, time traveled back to, and you feel like you're immersed in it. And one of the things I always admired about the show is it almost never winked at the conventions of the period. Like early on, everyone kind of laughed at how much the characters were smoking and things like that. But that was just sort of the show itself wasn't commenting on it. It was just a matter of fact about it. And the deeper in you got, the less sense there was of that, because you were accustomed to the smoking, to the sexism, to the racism, to all of these things that people at the time would take for granted and the show treated as taken for granted. And that's why it was so potent.
They also mostly avoided the tendency of a lot of historical fiction to give you one or more characters who represented the quote-unquote modern perspective, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that always drove me crazy. I'd go to see a movie, whether it's set in the 1940s or the 14th century, they'd have a character who represented basically a 21st century liberal, college-educated point of view on the period. And their whole point of the character like that is to stand there with their arms folded, disapproving of everybody else in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it always rang really false to me. It just felt like pandering to the audience. And I think it's a much more honest thing to do to try to construct a world that feels true based on what you know about the period and let people decide how they feel about that.
Yeah. So final question for both of you. What do you think is Mad Men's legacy and how do you see the influence of it on television today?
I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of shows that are trying to be Mad Men anymore. Do you, Alan?
There aren't. I mean, you could look at Mad Men as the obvious successor to The Sopranos, both because Weiner worked on both shows, but also because it was telling the same kind of really layered storytelling and, you know, treating each episode as its own short story. You don't get a lot of that now. It's very, like, intensely serialized. You know, you hear producers say things like, you know, I'm making a 10-hour movie, which is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's an inferiority complex about movies. I think.
You know, I used to say, you know, when I was recapping the show, I always said, like, this is my favorite show to write about. It wasn't always necessarily my favorite show, but it was my favorite show to write about because there was so much to unpack, so many levels on which everything took place, and there's barely been anything in the year since it ended that has given me quite the same level of joy when it comes time to do any kind of episodic recapping.
Matt Zoller-Seitz is editor-at-large of RogerEbert.com and a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. He's also the author of Mad Men Carousel, The Complete Critical Companion. Alan Sepinwall is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. You can find out more about Matt, Alan, and Mad Men at WPR.org/beta.
The covers that I like the most are the ones where the artist is really filtering what they love about the original song through their own performance and sensibility.
Music blogger Joshua Farber talks about cover versions in our latest rock and roll thought experiment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you want to rock, you gotta break the rules.
It's just a shame you missed out on rock and roll. It's over.
I hope we pass the audition.
Thought experiment.
And there used to be a way to stick it to the man. It was called rock and roll.
Welcome to another Beta Rock and Roll Thought Experiment. More rock and more thought. Today, Beta's senior rock and roll thought experiment correspondent, our very own Steve Gotcher, is going to uncover the secret history of cover versions. His guest in the laboratory is music blogger Joshua Farber.
In the early era of popular music, the idea of a cover song was unheard of. In the 1930s and 40s, people mostly bought records by song title rather than by artist. By the early 1950s, that changed. Listeners became more interested in specific musical artists, and some of those artists started performing songs that they wrote. Now, in case you're wondering, what's a cover song? It's a new version by someone other than the original composer of a previously released song, like this version of Radiohead's No Surprises by folk artist Emily Murr. But is a cover just a note-for-note remake of the original, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, I think it can't be a note-for-note recreation.
That's Joshua Farber, creator of the blog Cover Laydown, a site dedicated to covers of popular songs done in a more stripped-down acoustic style.
The covers that I like the most are the ones where the artist is really filtering what they love about the original song through their own performance and sensibility. And sometimes that results in what we might consider a relatively faithful cover, but one which clearly resonates with the artist that performs it. But sometimes that ends up with deconstructed music.
So a song stripped to its bones can take on a completely new meaning.
Caroline Herring, who performs Down South, she does a broken down version of several Cyndi Lauper songs over the course of her career that you have to know that she's covering a Cyndi Lauper song going in, or you won't even realize it until halfway through, even if you already know the original. And sometimes those performances are among the best covers there are because there's so much distance between the original and the what I would say is a reclamation of the original intent and the potential poetry of the lyrics and song. But I see your true colors shining through. You end up with this entirely different meaning when you see the product and get to listen to it at the end of that.
I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show. Your true colors are beautiful like a rainbow.
A great cover, then, is one that takes the original and brings new meaning through the instrumentation, arrangement, and the musical style.
You take a fast song, you slow it down, suddenly it's wistful. But one of the things I like about looking at the sort of acoustic and folk end of coverage specifically is that I think by making almost every song distilled down to where it's raw and really intimate, regardless of whether that's a single performer or a few performers in a room, I think that intimacy itself tends to change the way in which we hear a song and the way in which we interpret its meaning.
Or one can take a raw-sounding song like In Bloom by Nirvana and make it into a lovely country ballad like this version by Sturgill Simpson.
Likes to sing home, and likes to shoot his gun, but don't know what it means. Don't know what it means to love someone.
The meaning of a song is never the same for everyone. When an artist creates their interpretation, it can be like hearing the song for the first time and lead you to the discovery of new worlds of music and artists for your playlist.
Pulling those threads is one of the joys and dangers of being a cover lover of sorts, because you can follow those threads forever and never resurface back into the real world at all. At some point, if you stop listening to original songs altogether, of course, then all you're doing is recycling. So I think one of the challenges of being someone who spends so much time with covers is actually making sure that I keep following those threads to discover new music as well.
That's music blogger Joshua Farber. He talked with Beta Steve Gotcher. Steve's conversation with Joshua got us thinking about our favorite covers. We also put it to you alphas. Here's what we heard. Alpha Dan said, quote, "I don't think I'm the first one to say that the greatest cover songs do something new rather than mimicking the original. Thus, Johnny Cash's Hurt, a totally new spin on the Nine Inch Nails original. But at the same time, there's something to be said for the tribute cover, like Handle Me With Care, where Jenny Lewis, Ben Gibbard, Conor Oberst, and the Watson twins pay homage to the brilliant Wilburys." End quote. Thank you, Dan. And we also heard from Angie. She wrote, quote, "Disturbed has many great covers besides The Sound of Silence. I really like their cover of Land of Confusion by Genesis. Mudvayne has a very unique cover of King of Pain by The Police. The Bad Plus has the best cover of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit." End quote. Thank you, Angie. We decided to have a Beta roundtable to talk about cover versions. Our colleague Roz Gryert of Madison Power Pop Band Heavy Looks is here with us, and we also have Carl Christensen, executive producer, nay, showrunner of Zorba Pastor on Your Health with us. Carl is part of several Madison area bands. And last, but certainly not least, Beta's technical director and music director Steve Gotcher is here. Steve, you did a great job on that Joshua Farber interview. How did you discover Joshua?
I don't exactly remember, except that I have always been interested in cover music, mainly because I love taking a song that is powerful in its own right, having it deconstructed and then put together in a new way that gets you to look at it in a different way. And Joshua's take on it is going after acoustic music. He's very interested in folk and acoustic music. So his covers that he chooses are always folk and acoustic artists. And I found that those covers can be the most powerful because all the production is stripped away, and what you get is the lyrics and the very minimal arrangements that the folk artists do. And I have found so many of those to be really compelling and amazing.
Mm-hmm. Can you point to one thing that you learned about cover versions from your interview with Joshua?
I don't think so. I think it reinforced more things that I already knew about it than teaching me anything I didn't know about it.
Yeah, because you know a lot. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of music.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Roz, what songs has your band, Heavy Looks, covered?
We have covered several over the past several years, but when we first started our band, that's what we mostly did. We just got together to start playing music, and we played stuff by The Cars. We played Blondie covers, a lot of power pop stuff, because that's kind of what we were aiming for. So we kind of put that into our set and kind of grooved on it and made it our own. One that we actually play quite often, we pick a lot of 90s songs just for funsies when we're playing a show, because it's kind of out of nowhere. We play Flagpole Sitta by Harvey Danger. Mm. We also play Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba.
Mm, yeah.
you know, just to refresh people's memories that these were ones, you know, big hits, and they're fun, and people get into them. And
what's your philosophy in terms of, like, what do you look for? What are you trying to do when you do a cover version?
I think I'm just trying to really get the reaction from the crowd, like something like, oh man, I haven't heard that in so long, and it jogs their memory. But then we spin it with a little bit more of a punk sound and make it our own. I also think it's fun to take songs that were originally sung by men, and then I sing them.
Right.
Put it my own spin
on it.
Yeah,
puts a whole different spin on it.
For sure.
Absolutely. Carl, do you have favorite songs that you've covered over the years?
There's one band I play in, and I can't say the name on the air, on the radio, but we've done some pretty terrible covers, I guess, on purpose. One that stands out is Dreams by the Cranberries. We kind of played it straight, you know, like you talked about kind of putting your own twist on it. We pretty much, the instrumentation and everything, we played it just straight. But I have this vocal effect pedal where it throws my voice down an octave, and it kind of like this monster kind of sounding thing.
Yeah.
So it's a really straight cover, except for the vocals just sound really demented.
Yeah. And you also, the band whose name we can't say on the air, you've also done that great cover version of J.J. Cale's Cocaine, made famous by Eric Clapton. Tell me a bit about the story behind that.
It's actually, yeah, thanks. Thanks for mentioning that.
Thank you.
It's a cover of a cover of a cover, because basically, you know, like you said, J.J. Cale wrote the song. Eric Clapton made it famous. But what we were trying to do is there was this video going around YouTube a couple years ago of this local band somewhere in the South playing this song, this, you know, Cocaine. And it was some festival outside. It looked like it was in front of a music store, some local music store. And they were just struggling. Like, it was really, really, really rough. You know, like, it sounds like they didn't practice. The vocalist was reading the lyrics from a crumpled up piece of paper. And he kept shooting, you know, dagger looks at the guitarists as if he was the only one screwing up. But the entire band was completely, you know, especially the drummer. So we wanted to do a cover of that band's cover of Eric Clapton's cover of J.J. Cale's Cocaine.
Very
so
meta.
It's a cover of a cover.
Yeah, it's layers upon layers of meta.
Yeah.
So chunky you could eat it with a fork, but use a spoon. You'll want to get every drop.
It's like...
If you wanna get down on the ground, cocaine.
And how did people react to your cover of a cover of a cover?
Usually live, it gets a mixed response, but there was a semi-famous producer who happened to hear the song, Steve Albini, producer of a lot of rock bands over the years.
That's amazing.
He was driving into Madison for a conference he was doing, and he happened to hear our cover of Cocaine that was played on community radio. So we just got lucky, and he happened to hear it. And anyways, I get an email from Mr. Steve Albini saying how much he loved the cover and how much it made him laugh. So I think we just got really lucky.
That's awesome.
That's hilarious.
That's great.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you guys kind of do covers as parody sometimes, and maybe with, like, Tub Thumping. I don't know if you were trying to do, like, a true-to-life version of it.
Not so much. It was mostly just for fun.
Have you ever looked at a song and wanted to cover it as an homage to the song, or maybe trying to bring a new meaning to it?
I would say yes. So what Carl was saying, they covered the Cranberries, and I was actually in a Cranberries tribute band. So which were called an Uncranny Resemblance.
Oh, very good.
Uncranny Resemblance, yes.
But if it's a tribute band, then is. you're playing them faithfully, right?
Then
you're
I
trying
am.
To recreate
yes,
them.
Yes, yeah. we are. And yeah, so we also sang Dreams. And we put this together prior to the lead singer's death. So when we actually performed it, it was pretty emotional. It was actually very emotional because it was like, wow, we're actually singing these songs and giving life to them again. As if they're here.
Steve, I'm guessing there are several cover versions, favorites that you have. Is there one in particular?
Well, yeah, there are lots, but I'm going to speak to one that when I first heard it, I didn't even know it was a cover until I went, wait a minute, I've heard this before. What is it? It's Dolly Parton doing a Billy Joel tune, of all things, in a straight bluegrass style, really up-tempo, and it's called Travelin' Prayer. And you probably don't even know that song. It's actually, I believe it's the first song on his second album. And I'm not a Billy Joel fan.
Neither
but
am I.
I knew that song.
Neither am I. Sorry.
I knew that song. and when I heard her do it, I was just knocked out. First by the fact that it was just a great bluegrass version. But then I thought, this is a really good song.
Hey, Lord, take a look all around tonight and find out where my baby's gonna be. Hey, Lord, would you look out for him tonight, for he is far away from me.
Then when I realized it was Billy Joel, I thought, oh. Well, still a great song.
How did you discover it was Billy Joel?
Oh, like I say, I was listening to it and I realized, I know what this is. I know what this is. It took me a while to think about it, and then I went, oh my goodness, this is a Billy Joel tune. I can't believe it.
Yeah, so I'm curious what to know your all-time favorite cover versions are. Roz?
I don't know if you know the singer Anna Ternheim. She's Swedish, but I first heard of her in like 2007, and she does an amazing version of David Bowie's China Girl.
Oh.
And I didn't even realize it was China Girl at first because it's just so different. It's not poppy. It's really dark and kind of like dismal. I don't know, but it was beautiful and haunting and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I tend to listen to that a little bit more than I listen to David Bowie's version.
I could escape this feeling with China Girl. I feel a wreck without my little China Girl.
You feel a bit guilty about that?
A
it's
little
just the
bit.
Way you were saying.
A little bit. I love David Bowie so much, so, you know, nothing compares, but that cover is really awesome.
Cool. I'll have to check that out. Carl, what about you?
I like covers where you don't know who originally did it, and you hear the song, and you go through a lot of your life thinking that's the person who wrote the song. And I just found out recently, I was kind of doing a little research for this, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun is a cover. Maybe you guys knew that?
Yeah, no, that's right. Who did it originally?
Robert Hazard?
Yeah,
never
that's right.
Heard of him.
I only found that out within the last year.
Really?
Yeah.
Robert Hazard.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's such an iconic 80s song.
I just assumed Cyndi Lauper wrote
that. Yeah, and interesting that
it's
a man
so
would have originally
written
that.
Exactly. Yeah. That defines Cyndi Lauper for me, at least.
And another one, Carl?
So the other one, and it's pretty obvious, I think, for a lot of people, but I didn't know that Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, when I first heard it, you know, when The Bodyguard came out when I was in middle school, like when that came out, I just thought that's a Whitney Houston song.
Mm-hmm.
No idea
it's
a Dolly
too.
Parton
yeah.
song.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you hear the Dolly Parton song now that I'm older, and it's an amazing song, but the original is great too. So
I used to sing into a hairbrush on my bed to that song when I was a kid. That was for real. That was probably one of the first songs that I felt like I wanted to be a performer after I heard
that. Yeah, I know this isn't about me at all, but if I can just say quickly what my all-time favorite cover version is I Can't Get No Satisfaction, the Rolling Stones song, Devo's version, the Thinking Man Kisses version, because in that, with that robotic drum beat and just Mark Mothersbaugh's angst-ridden vocals, you really capture what the song is about that in a way that you don't get from the original. No disrespect to the Rolling Stones, but that you know, that's what I think anyway.
I like that version too. Mm-hmm. That's really great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This has been a Beta Roundtable. Thanks to my table mates, Rosalind Greyer.
Yeah, thank you.
Carl Christensen.
Thanks a lot.
And Steve Gotcher.
Thanks, Doug.
And we'd like to know what your favorite cover version is. Hit us up on Twitter at WPRBeta or send us an email, beta@WPR.org. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Mike Sachs, Matt Zoller-Seitz, Alan Seppenwall, and Joshua Farber. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's a decent man, isn't he? You wouldn't think he would be.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
This man is your commanding officer. You live and die in his shadow. Understood?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Well, as I said before, I'm from the Midwest. You were taught that it's not polite to talk about yourself.